Nothing in nature had that many feet. True, some things had that many legs, damp, wriggling things that live under rocks. But those weren't legs with feet, they were just legs that ended without ceremony. Something brighter than the shark might have been wary, but equals swung treacherously into play and shot it forward. That was its first mistake. In these circumstances, one mistake equals oblivion. Ridcully was waiting impatiently when, one by one, the senior wizards filed in from serious lecturing in room 3B. Senior wizards needed a lot of lecturing in order to digest their food. "Everyone here," he said. "Right, sit down. Listen carefully. Now, Vetinari hasn't had an albatross. It hasn't come all the way from the counterweight continent, and there isn't a strange message that we've got to obey, apparently. Follow me so far?" The senior wizards exchanged glances. "I think we may be a shade unclear on the detail," said the dean. "I was using diplomatic language. Could you perhaps try to be a little more indiscreet?" "We've got to send a wizard to the counterweight continent," said Ridcully, "and we've got to do it by tea time. Someone's asked for a great wizard, and it seems we've got to send one. Only they spell it W-I-Z-Z-A-R-D.
"Who?"
"Yes, librarian?" Unseen University's librarian, who had been dozing with his head on the table, was suddenly sitting bolt upright. Then he pushed back his chair, and arms waving wildly for balance, left the room at a bow-legged run. "Probably remembered an overdue book," said the dean. He lowered his voice. "Am I alone in thinking, by the way, that it doesn't add to the status of this university to have an ape on the faculty?" "Yes," said Ridcully flatly, "you are. We've got the only librarian who can rip off your arm with his leg. People respect that. Only the other day the head of the Thieves' Guild was asking me if we could turn their librarian into an ape. Besides, he's the only one of you buggers who stays awake more than an hour a day. Anyway." "Well, I find it embarrassing," said the dean. "Also, he's not a proper orangutan. I've been reading a book. It says a dominant male should have huge cheek pads. Has he got huge cheek pads? I don't think so. And..." "Shut up, Dean," said Ridcully, "or I won't let you go to the counterweight continent." "I don't see what raising a perfectly valid..." "What?" "They're asking for the great wizard," said Ridcully, "and I immediately thought of you. As the only man I know who can sit on two chairs at the same time," he added, silently. "The Empire?" squeaked the Dean. "Me? But they hate foreigners."
"So do you. You should get on famously."
"It's 6,000 miles, said the Dean, trying a new tack. "Everyone knows you can't get that far by magic."
As a matter of fact, you can, I think," said a voice from the other end of the table.
They all looked at Ponder Stibbons, the youngest and most depressingly keen member of the faculty. He was holding a complicated mechanism of sliding wooden bars and peering at the other wizards over the top of it.
Shouldn't be too much of a problem," he added. "People used to think it was, but I'm pretty sure it's all a matter of energy absorption and attention to relative velocities."
The statement was followed with the kind of mystified and suspicious silence that generally succeeded one of his remarks.
Relative velocities," said Ridcully.
"Yes, Arch-Chancellor."
Ponder looked down at his prototype slide rule and waited. He knew that Ridcully would feel it necessary to add a comment at this point in order to demonstrate that he'd grasped something.
"My mother could move like lightning when..."
"I mean, how fast things are going when compared to other things," Ponder said quickly, but not quite quickly enough. "We should be able to work it out quite easily. On Hex."
"Oh, no," said the lecturer in recent runes, pushing his chair back. "Not that. That's meddling with things you don't understand."
"Well, we are wizards," said Ridcully. "We're supposed to meddle with things we don't understand.
If we hung around waiting till we understood things, we'd never get anything done.
Look, I don't mind summoning some demon and asking it, said the lecturer in recent runes. That's normal. But building some mechanical contrivance to do your thinking for you, that's against nature. Besides, he added, in slightly less foreboding tones, last time you did a big problem on it, the wretched thing broke, and we had ants all over the place.
We've sorted that out, said Ponder.
I must admit, there was a ram's skull in the middle of it last time I looked, said Ridcully.
We had to add that to do occult transformations, said Ponder. But...
And cogwheels and springs, the Arch-Chancellor went on.
Well, the ants aren't very good at differential analysis, so...
And that strange wobbly thing with the cuckoo?
The unreal time clock, said Ponder. Yes, we think that's essential for working out...
Anyway, it's all quite immaterial, because I certainly have no intention of going anywhere, said the Dean. Send a student if you must. We've got a lot of spare ones.
Good so be would you if doth plum of helping second A, said the bursar.
The table fell silent.
Anyone understand that? Said Ridcully.
The bursar was not technically insane. He had passed through the rapids of insanity some time previously, and was now sculling around in some peaceful pool on the other side. He was often quite coherent, although not by normal human standards.
He's going through yesterday again, said the senior wrangler. Backwards this time.
We should send the bursar, said the dean firmly.
Certainly not. You probably can't get dried frog pills there.
The librarian re-entered the study at a bandy-legged run, waving something in the air. It was red, or at least had some time been red. It might well once have been a pointy hat, but the point had crumpled and most of the brim was burned away. A word had been embroidered on it in sequins. Many had been burned off, but wizard could just be made out as pale letters on the scorched cloth.
"I knew I'd seen it before," said Ridcully. "On a shelf in the library, right?"
The Arch-Chancellor inspected the remnant.
"Wizard," he said. "What kind of sad, hopeless person needs to write wizard on their hat?"
A few bubbles broke the surface of the sea, causing the raft to rock a little. After a while, a couple of pieces of shark skin floated up. Rincewind sighed and put down his fishing rod. The rest of the shark would be dragged ashore later, he knew it. He couldn't imagine why. It wasn't as if they were good eating. They tasted like old boots soaked in urine. He picked up a makeshift oar and set out for the beach. It wasn't a bad little island. Storms seemed to pass it by. So did ships, but there were coconuts and breadfruit and some sort of wild fig. Even his experiments in alcohol had been quite successful, although he hadn't been able to walk properly for 2 days. The lagoon provided prawns and shrimps and oysters and crabs and lobsters, and in the deep green water out beyond the reef, big silver fish fought each other for the privilege of biting a piece of bent wire on the end of a bit of string. After 6 months on the island, in fact, there was only one thing Rincewind lacked. He'd never really thought about it before. Now he thought about it. Or more correctly, them. All the time. It was odd. He'd hardly ever thought about them in Ankh-Morpork, because they were there if he ever wanted them. Now they weren't, and he craved. His raft bumped the white sand at about the same moment as a large canoe rounded the reef and entered the lagoon. Ridcully was sitting at his desk now, surrounded by his senior wizards. They were trying to tell him things, despite the known danger of trying to tell Ridcully things, which was that he picked up the facts he liked and let the others take a running jump.
So, he said, not a kind of cheese.
No, Arch-Chancellor, said the Chair of Indefinite Studies. Rincewind is a kind of wizard.
Was, said the lecturer in recent runes.
Not a cheese, said Ridcully, unwilling to let go of a fact.
No. Sounds the sort of name you'd associate with cheese. I mean, a pound of mature Rincewind. It rolls off the tongue.
"God's damn it, Rincewind is not a cheese," shouted the Dean, his temper briefly cracking. "Rincewind is not a yoghurt or any kind of sour milk derivative. Rincewind is a bloody nuisance, a complete and utter disgrace to wizardry, a fool, a failure. Anyway, he hasn't been seen here since that unpleasantness with the sorcerer, years ago."
"Really?" said Ridcully, with a certain kind of nasty politeness. "A lot of wizards behaved very badly then, I understand."
"Yes, indeed," said the lecturer in recent runes, scowling at the Dean, who bridled. "I don't know anything about that, runes. I wasn't Dean at the time."
"No, but you were very senior."
"Perhaps, but it just so happens that at the time I was visiting my aunt, for your information. They nearly blew up the whole city." She lives in Quirm, and Quirm was heavily involved, as I recall. Near Quirm, not all that near, actually, quite a way along the coast.
Anyway, you seem to be very well informed, eh, runes?" said the Dean.
I was studying hard at the time, hardly knew what was going on.
"Half the university was blown down," the Dean remembered himself and added, "That is, so I heard, later, after getting back from my aunt's."
"Yes, but I've got a very thick door. And I happen to know the senior wrangler was here, because with that heavy green baize stuff you can hardly hear any—" "Nap for time it, think I," said the bursar. "Will you all shut up right now this minute?"
Ridcully glared at his faculty with the clear, innocent glare of someone who was blessed at birth with no imagination whatsoever, and who had genuinely been hundreds of miles away during the university's recently embarrassing history.
"Right," he said, when they'd quietened down. "This Rincewind, bit of an idiot, yes? You talk, Dean. Everyone else was shut up."
The Dean looked uncertain.
"Well, I mean, it makes no sense, Arch-Chancellor. He couldn't even do proper magic. What good would he be to anyone? Besides, where Rincewind went," he lowered his voice, "trouble followed behind."
Ridcully noticed that the wizards drew a little closer together.
"Sounds all right to me," he said. "Best place for trouble, behind. You certainly don't want it in front."
"You don't understand, Arch-Chancellor," said the Dean. "It followed behind on hundreds of little legs."
The Arch-Chancellor's smile stayed where it was, while the rest of his face went solid behind it.
"You, been on the bursar's pills, Dean?"
"I assure you, Mustrum."
"Then don't talk rubbish."
"Very well, Arch-Chancellor, but you do realise, don't you, that it might take years to find him?"
Said Ponder, "if we can work out his thaumic signature, I think Hex could probably do it in a day."
The Dean glared.
"That's not magic," he snapped. "That's just engineering."
Rincewind trudged through the shallows and used a sharp rock to hack the top of a coconut that had been cooling in a convenient shady rock pool. He put it to his lips. A shadow fell across him. It said,
Hello?
It was possible, if you kept on talking at the Arch-Chancellor for long enough, that some facts might squeeze through.
"So, what you're telling me," said Ridcully eventually, "is that this Rincewind fella has been chased by just about every army in the world, has been bounced around like a pea on a drum, and probably is the one wizard who knows anything about the Agatian Empire on account of once being friends with—" he glanced at his notes— "a strange little man in glasses who came from there and gave him this funny thing with the legs you all keep alluding to. And he can speak the lingo. Am I right so far?"
"Exactly, Arch-Chancellor. Call me an idiot if you like," said the Dean. "But why would anyone want him?" Ridcully looked down at his notes again.
"You've decided to go, then?"
"No, of course not."
"What I don't think you've, spotted here, Dean," he said, breaking into a determinedly cheery grin, "is what I might call the common denominator. Chap stays alive. Talented. Find him and bring him here, wherever he is. Poor chap could be facing something dreadful."
The coconut stayed where it was, but Rincewind's eyes swiveled madly from side to side. Three figures stepped into his line of vision. They were obviously female. They were abundantly female. They were not wearing a great deal of clothing and seemed to be altogether too fresh from the hairdressers for people who had just been paddling a large war canoe. But this is often the case with beautiful Amazonian warriors. A thin trickle of coconut milk began to dribble off the end of Rincewind's beard. The leading woman brushed aside her long blonde hair and gave him a bright smile.
"I know this sounds a little unlikely," she said, "but I and my sisters here represent a hitherto undiscovered tribe whose menfolk were recently destroyed in a deadly but short-lived and highly specific plague. Now we have been searching these islands for a man to enable us to carry on our line."
"How much do you think he weighs?"
Rincewind's eyebrows raised. The woman looked down shyly.
"You may be wondering why we are all blonde and white-skinned when everyone else in the islands around here is dark," she said. "It just seems to be one of those genetic things."
"About 120, 125 pounds. Put another pound or two of junk on the heap. Can you detect, you know, it?"
"This is all going to go wrong, Mr. Stibbons. I just know it."
"He's only 600 miles away, and we know where we are, and he's on the right half of the disc. Anyway, I've worked this out on Hex, so nothing can possibly go wrong."
"Yes, but can anyone see that, you know, with the feet?"
Rincewind's eyebrows waggled. A sort of choking noise came from his throat.
"Can't see it? Will you lot stop huffing on my crystal ball?"
"And, of course, if you were to come with us, we could promise you earthly and sensual pleasures, such as those of which you may have dreamed."
"All right, on the count of three."
The coconut dropped away. Rincewind swallowed. There was a hungry, dreamy look in his eyes.
"Can I have them mashed?" he said.
"Now!"
First, there was a sensation of pressure. The world opened up in front of Rincewind and sucked him into it. Then it stretched out thin and went twang. Cloud rushed past him, blurred by speed. When he dared open his eyes again, it was to see far ahead of him a tiny black dot. It got bigger. It resolved itself into a tight cloud of objects. There were a couple of heavy saucepans, a large brass candlestick, a few bricks, a chair, and a large brass blancmange mould in the shape of a castle. They hit him one after the other, the blancmange mould making a humorous clang as it bounced off his head, and then whirled away behind him. The next thing ahead of him was an octagon, a chalked one. He hit it. Ridcully stared down.
A shade less than 125 pounds, I fancy," he said. "All the same, well done, gentlemen."
The dishevelled scarecrow in the centre of the circle staggered to its feet and beat out one or two small fires in its clothing. Then it looked around blearily and said,
"He could be a little disorientated," the Arch-Chancellor went on. "More than 600 miles in 2 seconds, after all. Don't give him a nasty shock."
"Like sleepwalkers, you mean?"
said the senior wrangler.
What do you mean, sleepwalkers?"
"If you wake sleepwalkers, their legs drop off. So my grandmother used to aver."
"And we are sure it's Rincewind," said the Dean.
"Of course it's Rincewind," said the senior wrangler. "We spent hours looking for him."
"It could be some dangerous occult creature," said the Dean stubbornly.
"With that hat?"
It was a pointy hat, in a way, a kind of cargo cult pointy hat, made out of a split bamboo and coconut leaves, in the hope of attracting passing wizardliness. Picked out on it, in seashells held in place with grass, was the word Wizard. Its wearer gazed right through the wizards, and, as if driven by some sudden recollection of purpose, lurched abruptly out of the octagon and headed towards the door of the hall. The wizards followed cautiously.
"I'm not sure I believe her. How many times did she see it happen?"
"I don't know. She never said."
"The bursar sleepwalks most nights, you know."
"Does he? Tempting." Rincewind, if that was the creature's name, headed out into Sator Square. It was crowded. The air shimmered over the braziers of chestnut sellers and hot potato merchants and echoed with the traditional street cries of old Ankh Morpork,
such as, "Ouch! Arg! Give me back my money, you scoundrel!" and "You call these chestnuts? I call them little balls of charcoal. That's what I call them."
The figure sidled up to a skinny man in a huge overcoat, who was frying something over a little oil heater in a wide tray around his neck. The possibly Rincewind grabbed the edge of the tray.
"Got any potatoes?" it growled.
"Potatoes? No, squire. Got some sausages in a bun."
The possibly Rincewind froze, and then it burst into tears.
"Sausage in a bun," it bawled. "Dear old sausage in a bun. Gimme sausage in a bun."
It grabbed three off the tray and tried to eat them all at once.
"Good grief," said Ridcully.
The figure half ran, half capered away, fragments of bun and pork product debris cascading from its unkempt beard.
"I've never seen anyone eat three of Throat Dibbler's sausage in a bun and look so happy,"
said the senior wrangler.
"I've never seen someone eat three of Throat Dibbler's sausages in a bun and look so upright," said the dean.
"I've never seen anyone eat anything of Dibbler's and get away without paying,"
said the lecturer in recent runes. The figure spun happily around the square, tears streaming down its face. The gyrations took it past an alley mouth, whereupon a smaller figure stepped out behind it and, with some difficulty, hit it on the back of the head. The sausage-eater fell to his knees, saying to the world in general,
"Ow." "No, no, 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 no."
A rather older man stepped out and removed the cosh from the young man's hesitant hands, while the victim knelt and moaned.
"I think you ought to apologise to the poor gentleman," said the old man. "I don't know what's he going to think. I mean, look at him. He made it so easy for you, and what does he get? I mean, what did you think you were doing?"
"Mumble, mumble, mumble, Mr. Boggis," said the boy, looking at his feet.
"What was that again? Speak up."
"Overarm belter, Mr. Boggis."
"That was an overarm belter? You call that an overarm belter? That was an overarm belter, was it? This, excuse me, sir, we'll just have you up on your feet for a moment. Sorry about this. This is an overarm belter?"
"Ow," shouted the victim, and then to the surprise of all concerned, he added,
"What you did was, sorry to impose again, sir, this won't take a minute. What you did was this. Ow!" "Now, you lot, you saw that. Come on, gather round."
Half a dozen other youths slouched out of the alleyways and formed a ragged audience around Mr. Boggis. The luckless student and the victim, who were staggering in a circle and making little moo, moo sounds, but still, for some reason, apparently enjoying himself immensely.
"Now," said Mr. Boggis, with the air of an old skilled craftsman imparting his professional expertise to an ungrateful posterity, "when inconveniencing a customer from your basic alley entrance, the correct procedure is..." "Oh, hello, Mr. Redcully. Didn't see you there."
The Arch-Chancellor gave him a friendly nod.
"Don't mind us, Mr. Boggis. Thieves' Guild training, is it?"
Boggis rolled his eyes.
"Don't know what they teaches them at school," he said. "It's just nothing but reading and writing all the time. When I was a lad, school was where you learned something useful. Right, you, Wilkins, stop that giggling. You have a go. Excuse us just one other moment, sir."
"Ow!
No. My old granny could do better than that. Now, look. You steps up trimly, places one hand on his shoulder here, for control. Go on, you do it. And then smartly... Ow! All right, can anyone tell me what he was doing wrong?
The figure crawled away unnoticed, except by the wizards, while Mr. Boggis was demonstrating the finer points of head percussion on Wilkins. It staggered to his feet and plunged along the road, still moving like one hypnotized.
"He's crying," said the Dean.
"Not surprising," said the Arch-Chancellor. "But why is he grinning at the same time?"
"Curiouser and curiouser,"
said the senior wrangler. Bruised and possibly poisoned, the figure headed back for the university, the wizard still trailing behind.
"You must mean curious and more curious, surely. And even then it doesn't make much sense."
It entered the gates, but this time hurried jerkily through the main hall and into the library. The librarian was waiting, holding, with something of a smirk on his face, and an orangutan can really smirk, the battered hat.
"Amazing," said Ridcully. It's true. A wizard will always come back for his hat."
The figure grabbed the hat, evicted some spiders, threw away the sad affair made of leaves, and put the hat on his head. Rincewind blinked at the puzzled faculty. A light came on behind his eyes for the first time, as if up to now he'd merely been operating by reflex reaction.
What have I just eaten?"
Three of Mr. Dibbler's finest sausages," said Ridcully. "Well, when I say finest, I mean most typical, don't you know?"
"I see. And who just hit me?"
"Thieves' Guild apprentices out training."
Rincewind blinked.
"This is Ankh Morpork, isn't it?"
"Yes." "I thought so."
Rincewind blinked slowly.
"Well," he said, just as he fell forward, "I'm back."
Lord Hong was flying a kite. It was something he did perfectly. Lord Hong did everything perfectly. His watercolours were perfect. His poetry was perfect. When he folded paper, every crease was perfect. Imaginative, original, and definitely perfect. Lord Hong had long ago ceased pursuing perfection because he already had it nailed up in a dungeon somewhere. Lord Hong was 26 and thin and handsome. He wore very small, very circular, steel-rimmed spectacles. When asked to describe him, people often used the word smooth or even lacquered.
And often the phrase, "a bastard you don't want to cross, and I didn't say that."
And he had risen to the leadership of one of the most influential families in the Empire by relentless application, total focusing of his mental powers, and six well-executed deaths. The last one had been that of his father, who died happy in the knowledge that his son was maintaining an old family tradition. The senior families venerated their ancestors and saw no harm in prematurely adding to their number. And now his kite, the black kite with the two big eyes, plunged out of the sky. He'd calculated the angle, needless to say, perfectly. Its string, coated with glue and ground glass, soared through those of his fellow contestants and sent their kites tumbling. There was genteel applause from the bystanders. People generally found it advisable to applaud Lord Hong. He handed the string to a servant, nodded curtly at the fellow flyers, and strode towards his tent. Once inside, he sat down and looked at his visitor.
"Well,"
he said.
"We sent the message,"
said the visitor.
"No one saw us." "On the contrary,"
said Lord Hong,
20 people saw you. Do you know how hard it is for a guard to look straight ahead and see nothing when people are creeping around, making a noise like an army, and whispering to one another to be quiet? Frankly, your people do not seem to possess that revolutionary spark. What is the matter with your hand?" "The albatross bit it."
Lord Hong smiled. It occurred to him that it might have mistaken his visitor for an anchovy, and with some justification. There was the same fishy look about the eyes.
"I don't understand, O Lord,"
said the visitor, whose name was Two Fire Herb.
"Good. But they believe in the great wizard, and you want him to come here?"
Oh, certainly. I have my people in...
He tried the alien syllables.
Ankh-Morpork. The one so foolishly called the Great Wizard does exist, but I might tell you he is renowned for being incompetent, cowardly, and spineless. Quite proverbially so. So I think the Red Army should have their leader, don't you? It will raise their morale.
He smiled again.
This is politics, he said. Ah, now go.
Lord Hong picked up a book as his visitor left, but it was hardly a real book. Pieces of paper had simply been fastened together with string, and the text was handwritten. He'd read it many times before. It still amused him, mainly because the author had managed to be wrong about so many things. Now, every time he finished a page, he ripped it out, and while reading the next page, carefully folded the paper into the shape of a chrysanthemum.
"Great wizard," he said aloud. "Oh, indeed, very great."